Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 10, which I will call Judgment on Arrogant Assyria. Isaiah begins now in chapter 10, verses 1 through 4. Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. What would you do on the day of reckoning when disaster comes from afar? To whom would you run for help? Where will you leave your riches? Nothing will remain but to cringe among the captives or fall among the slain. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away, his hand is still upraised. Talking about God's hand. Now, what are the options as to when this prophecy was given? If I had to guess, I would say the majority view is that the prophecy was given after the fall of northern Israel to Assyria in 722 BC, and that it was given between the fall of Samaria in 722 and the invasion of Judah by Sennacherib of Assyria in 701 BC. The Cambridge Commentary spots it as somewhere between 717 and 701 BC. Well, if this is so, then verses 1 through 4, which I just read, is a condemnation of Judah, not northern Israel. Northern Israel having gone down previously in 722. Now let me read you what Barnes says about this issue. When the prophecy was uttered, and in regard to whom has been a question, Vitringa supposes that it was uttered in immediate connection with the foregoing. He's talking about the foregoing four verses that we're interested in here that I just read. Vitringa supposes that there was a connection in Isaiah 10 verses 5 to the end of the chapter, verse 34, to these first four verses. Vitringa says that in fact, the two sections are together. The prophecy talked about in verses 5 through 32 is a part of verses 1 through 4, but Barnes continues, but from Isaiah 10:9, Isaiah 10:11, it is evident that at the time this prophecy was uttered, Samaria was destroyed. And from Isaiah 10:20, it is clear that it was after the 10 tribes had been carried into captivity, and when the Assyrians supposed that he could accomplish the same destruction in captivity in regard to Jerusalem and Judah. So Barnes quotes three of the verses in our chapter to show or to try to prove that Isaiah was prophesying after 722 BC and therefore he was not prophesying against northern Israel not being in existence, but he's prophesying against Judah, referring, of course, to the famous Assyrian invasion against Hezekiah in 701 BC. Now the three verses that Barnes quotes are verses 9, 11, and 20. I'll read them to you. Isaiah 10:9. Isn't Calno like Carchemish? Isn't Hamath like Arpad? Isn't Samaria like Damascus? Now, what is being said in verse 9, it's a quotation of the Assyrian king. The Assyrian king is bragging. I've destroyed all these cities. I've destroyed Calno just like I've destroyed Carchemish. I've destroyed Hamath in Syria just like I've destroyed Arpad. And likewise, I've destroyed Samaria like I've destroyed Damascus. So that means Samaria is kaputsky. So this must be after 722 that this Assyrian king is speaking, and therefore after 722 when Isaiah is writing his prophecy or giving his prophecy. Isaiah 10:11, the Assyrian king says, as I did to Samaria, that's the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel, as I did to Samaria and its idols, will I not also do to Jerusalem and its idols? In other words, I'm going to destroy Jerusalem. I've already destroyed Samaria. So that's after 722. Isaiah 10:20. On that day, the remnant of Israel and the survivors of the house of Jacob will no longer depend on the one who struck them, but they will faithfully depend on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. The idea being that the northern kingdom of Israel didn't depend on Assyria anymore because Assyria had wiped them out. That was in 733 or so BC, 733/732. So those three verses convince Barnes that the prophecy was given after 722 and referred to Sennacherib of Assyria coming in to besiege Hezekiah of Judah in 701 BC. Cambridge agrees with that, and I think that's pretty strong evidence. However, you could make an argument that Isaiah prophesied before 722 BC. You have to assume that northern Israel is included in the condemnations of chapter 9, the previous chapter. Ellicott believes that. Well, if Israel, northern Israel was condemned in the previous chapter, and then verses 1 through 4 are a continuation of that chapter 9, then that means that verses 1 through 4 of chapter 10 are also condemning northern Israel. Here's the reasoning. Chapter 9 condemns northern Israel as well as Judah. Chapters 10, verses 1 through 4 is connected to chapter 9. Therefore, chapters 10, 1 through 4 condemns northern Israel. Being condemned, northern Israel must still be in existence. At the time that verses 1 through 4 were written, northern Israel was destroyed in 722. So therefore, chapter 10, verses 1 through 4 must have been written before 722. Now, that line of reasoning relies on an assumption that chapter 9 was a prophecy against both northern Israel and Judah, and that question can be assumed. But first, let me give you a couple of comments from two commentators showing that the first four verses of chapter 10 are hooked with the last part of chapter 9. Here's Benson, quote, "The first four verses of this chapter are closely connected with the foregoing and ought to have been joined thereto, being a continuation of the subject treated of in it." Barnes, quote, "Isaiah 10, verses 1 through 4, closes the prophecy commenced in Isaiah 9:8 and should have been connected with that in the division into chapters." Okay, so verses 1 through 4, I think there's no question. The commentators seem to agree they should be hooked to chapter 9. But the question is, does chapter 9 refer to judgment on Israel, at least partially? Because if it does, then that means that Isaiah 10, 1 through 4 could also be referring to judgment on Israel. And then, if you connect chapter 10, verses 5 through 34 with the first four verses, then that means that prophecy could also be spoken against northern Israel. That's the way the argument would go, and some commentators make that argument. I don't see how they get around the fact that in the last part of Isaiah chapter 10, Samaria is referred to as having been destroyed. I don't know how you get around that. Ellicott, to prove or to try to show that the last part of chapter 9 referred to judgment on northern Israel, at least partially, is because of Isaiah 9:14. "So the Lord cut off Israel's head and tail, palm branch and reed in a single day." Israel, is that referring to northern Israel or Judah? Probably northern Israel, and so that's the argument that Ellicott is making. But Ellicott does say it's Israel as including Judah, so it's both Judah and Israel, and pulpit commentary says the same. Well, at any rate, I'm sure you are just as confused as I am as to the issues involved here. Let me summarize all the speculations. First of all, there are three sections of Scripture in play. The end of chapter 9, Isaiah 10, 1 through 4. Section 2 and section 3 is Isaiah 10, verses 5 through 34. And the factors that need to be considered in examining those three sections, are they linked together and therefore referring to the same event? Or two out of three linked? 1 and 3, 2 and 3, are they linked? Another factor to be considered, which destruction is being referred to in each section? Is it judgment on Samaria, northern Israel, in 722, or is it judgment on Judah in 701 by Sennacherib? And then, of course, when was each section written, or more precisely, when did Isaiah prophesy each section? It might have been written down later. But all of that creates total confusion and uncertainty. So let me say this. Whenever the prophecy was given, the object is obviously Sennacherib in Assyria. When we get to the end of the chapter, things will become clearer. We read in Isaiah 10, verses 16 through 17, "Therefore the Lord God of hosts will inflict an emaciating disease on the well-fed of Assyria, and he will kindle a burning fire under its glory. Israel's light will become a fire and its Holy One a flame, and one day it will burn up Assyria's thorns and thistles." That obviously refers to what happened when Sennacherib invaded Hezekiah. Sennacherib's army woke up the next morning and they were all dead because of plague. And one day the fire of God will burn up Assyria. This is talking about Assyria at the end. And when I say Assyria, I mean Assyria under Sennacherib in 701, not Assyria under Shalmaneser V and Sargon II in 722 when they destroyed northern Israel. At least that's the assumption I'm going to go on. It's all debatable. So going back to verse 1, "Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees," whether in Israel or Judah, I don't know. Could be both. These decrees would be decrees by politicians, government officials, as well as by judicial officials. They deprive the poor of their rights. Laws were made which discouraged the poor from any possibility of application for justice, and when they did pursue a lawsuit, they were harassed with long, vexatious, and expensive suits, so they had to get a lawyer. And you know what that means. If the poor persisted in their lawsuits, the cause was usually decided against them and for the rich, because the courts would favor the rich, especially if the judges were bribed. Notice that Judah and or northern Israel were making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. Those are two categories that are especially weak, and it's especially offensive to oppress them. Pure and undefiled religion is to take care of the widows and orphans. As the Apostle John said, I was told when I was in law school, get your client into the category of widows and orphans because the law loves widows and orphans, but not the law in ancient Judah or ancient northern Israel. What will you do on the day of reckoning when disaster comes from afar? Now the options here for that day of reckoning, that could be Assyria under Shalmaneser V and Sargon II in 722. It could be Assyria under Sennacherib in 701 B.C., or it could be Babylon in 587-586, or the Roman destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. So that's the thing. Israel or northern Israel have been judged biblically, hugely, four times at least. And so whenever there's a prophecy of destruction on the people of God, it opens up a possibility that it could be one of these four destructions. Now, John Gill always says it's the Romans in AD 70. But why go there? Why not say it's either Assyria at 722 on northern Israel or Assyria under Sennacherib in 701 on southern Israel? Those are the two events closest to Isaiah. It would make more sense that that's what he's prophesying about. Now, John Gill tries to say that the day of reckoning for the people of God is in AD 70 by the Romans because the day of reckoning, as translated by the KJV as day of visitation, is the same phrase used by Luke referring to the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. They will crush you and your children within you to the ground, and they will not leave one stone or another in you because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. That's referring to AD 70. Well, that's true. The phrase is similar, but I don't think it ties the two events together. I'm assuming it's either 722. In fact, I actually have preferred that it's Assyria under Sennacherib in 701. Adam Clark agrees with me, and I think he's right, but I wouldn't bet my life on it. Now, the disaster coming on the people of God comes from afar in verse 3. That's because Assyria was a long way off in the Mesopotamian Valley. In verse 4, Isaiah says, nothing will remain but to cringe among the captives or fall among the slain. In other words, you're dead, you're captured. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away, his hand is still upraised. In other words, you're going to go down, but there's some more judgment coming later. Well, that could be the Babylonian captivity came later, 586, could be AD 70. Just a general prediction of disaster on the people of God. We go down to Isaiah 10, verses 5 through 11. Isaiah continues, woe to the Assyrian, the rod of my anger, in whose hand is the club of my wrath. I send him against a godless nation. I dispatch him against the people who anger me, to seize loot and snatch plunder, and to trample them down like mud in the streets. But this is not what he intends. This is not what he has in mind. His purpose is to destroy, to put an end to many nations. Are not my commanders all kings, he says? Has not Calno fared like Carchemish? Is not Hamath like Arpad, and Samaria like Damascus? Has my hand seized the kingdoms of the idols, kingdoms whose images excel those of Jerusalem and Samaria? Shall I not deal with Jerusalem and her images as I dealt with Samaria and her idols? Now, in verse 5, Isaiah says, woe to the Assyrian. That seems to me to pretty well tie it down. This is talking about one of those two Assyrian invasions, either 722 against Samaria or 701 against Jerusalem. 701 is the attack on the southern kingdom of Judah, 722 on the northern kingdom of Israel. But now Isaiah switches from judgment on his people, whichever people it was, Judah or northern Israel. He switches from that to talk about how now he's going to take care of the Assyrians. He says the Assyrians have the club of God's wrath in the Assyrians' hand. That's because God was using the Assyrians to beat the mud out of his sinful people, the Judahites and or the northern Israelites. Verse 6, Isaiah says that he's quoting God, Yahweh, I, Yahweh, send Assyria against a godless nation. And again, that godless nation is either Judah or Judah and northern Israel together. God says, I dispatch him, I dispatch Assyria against the people who anger me. God says he's anger. God, Isaiah says that God dispatches against a people who anger him, namely the northern Israelites or the people of Judea. They anger God, and Assyria is going to loot and snatch plunder, trample them down like mud in the streets. Verse 7, but this is not what he, that's Assyria, intends. What is not what Assyria intends? Well, Assyria was trying to get booty. They weren't intending to carry out the justice of God. And that just, of course, proves how God will use pagan peoples, unbelievers, to carry out his purposes. But that doesn't mean that the nations that he uses to carry out his purposes are going to avoid his judgments. Their time is coming. So in verse 7, God says, of Assyria, this is not what he intends to discipline the Jews. This is not what he has in mind. What is his purpose? His purpose is to destroy and put an end to many nations. God's purpose was not to destroy Israel, but to chastise them. Assyria's purpose was to destroy them. Now in verse 8, Assyria starts bragging, are not my commanders all kings? That could mean that Assyria's military commanders were kings of previously conquered kingdoms, or it could mean that Assyria's commanders were so noble they were like kings. Either way, the idea that the boastful Assyrian boast conveys is that Assyrians have commanders who are so mighty that they're equal to the task of conquering the known world. And then we have a list of cities that are going to be destroyed. And next in verse 9, we have a list of cities that have been destroyed by Assyria. And the hypothetical Assyrian king here is quoting them. Has not Calno, that place is unknown, nobody knows where it is, feared like Carchemish? In other words, Carchemish has gone down. Calno has gone down. Carchemish is now on the frontier between Turkey and Syria. It was the location of an important battle between the Babylonians and Egyptians. That battle was in 605 BC when the Babylonians decisively defeated the Egyptians and the remnants of the Assyrians in 605, which is kind of ironic because now, in a previous time, Assyria has won at Carchemish and they're bragging about it. It's ironic that that's where their mighty empire is going to go down in 605 BC. That's a famous battle in ancient history. But earlier than 605, maybe a century earlier, right in the area, right during the time that we're talking about now, Assyria is bragging about what happened at Carchemish. The Cambridge commentator says it's a great center of the Hittite Confederacy. Carchemish had been frequently subdued by Assyrian kings and was ultimately incorporated in the empire by Sargon II in 717. So, again, Assyria's bragging about the cities it's conquered. Calno, Carchemish, Nehemeth, and Arpad are around Damascus. They're always mentioned as being around Damascus. Syria to the north and northeast of Israel, right at the opening of the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon ranges as you go north. Hamath and Arpad are almost always in the Bible mentioned along with Damascus. For example, in Jeremiah 49:23, about Damascus, colon, Hamath and Arpad are put to shame. So that's the general area up there. Now, in verse 9, the Assyrian king is bragging, isn't Samaria like Damascus? Now, that's interesting because Damascus, of course, was taken, we know, in 732 under Tiglath-Pileser III by the Assyrians. And here in verse 9, this braggadocious hypothetical Assyrian king is saying, hasn't Samaria been taken like Damascus? He actually says, isn't Samaria like Damascus? In other words, Damascus has been taken, so Samaria has been taken, which makes me think, as I mentioned earlier, that this prophecy is given after Samaria had been taken, after 722, and so the condemnations of Isaiah's prophecies, at least from verse 5 onward, are aimed at Judah, not northern Israel. But I'll leave that question open. Maybe there's some way to get around that I don't know about. Maybe there's some way to get around the fact that Samaria is listed here as having been conquered that I don't know about. In verse 10, the Assyrian king says, as my hand sees the kingdoms of the idols, kingdoms whose images excel those of Jerusalem and Samaria. Oh, Jerusalem and Samaria have idols? Isn't that the home of Yahweh? The same Yahweh who says, you shall have no other gods before me? Well, Assyria, of course, conquered all the nations in the ancient Near East, all of whom were idolaters, in the Levant, the Hittite kingdom, the kingdoms in the Mesopotamian Valley, Syria, all these kingdoms, they were idolaters. But then he says that, likewise, Jerusalem and Samaria have idols. And in fact, their idols are inferior to the idols of other nations. Now, of course, the point of saying they were inferior is because Assyria planned on conquering Jerusalem and Samaria. These ancient kingdoms thought that idols protected their particular territory. And so Jerusalem and Samaria have gone down in the case of Samaria and is going to go down in the case of Jerusalem in 701. Now, why would the king of Assyria say that Jerusalem had idols? or that Samaria had idols. As Barnes says, quote, Jerusalem and Samaria had often been guilty of the worship of idols, and it is probable that Sennacherib regarded them as idolaters in the same sense as other nations. I've been saying the hypothetical Assyrian emperor. Barnes says this emperor is Sennacherib. Maybe he's right. It is not improbable that he was aware that Jerusalem worshipped Yahweh, but he doubtless regarded Yahweh as a mere tutelary divinity, the special god of that land, a local god, in other words, a nothing burger god. So he's arrogant, but it does show that Israel and Samaria had idols. As we know, the whole history of the nation of Israel, both north and south, was a history of idolatry and apostasy from their Lord. We go now to verses 12 through 19 of Isaiah 10. When the Lord has finished all his work against Mount Zion and Jerusalem, he will say, I will punish the king of Assyria for the willful pride of his heart and the haughty look in his eyes. Mount Zion and Jerusalem, again, that's an indication that this verse is talking about judgment on Jerusalem, not Samaria. So therefore, it is referring to the judgment on Jerusalem in 701 by Sennacherib. So God will say, after he's finished all of his work against Jerusalem, in other words, after Sennacherib finishes his work against the whole land of Israel, God says, I will punish the king of Assyria for the willful pride of his heart and the haughty look in his eyes. For he says, by the strength of my hand I have done this, and by my wisdom, because I have understanding. I removed the boundaries of nations, I plundered their treasuries, like a mighty one I subdued their kings. As one reaches into a nest, so my hand reached for the wealth of the nations. As men gather abandoned eggs, so I gathered all the countries. What he means by that is it's easy to get eggs out of a bird's nest when the mother bird's not there, but if the mother bird is there, she'll peck and scream and chirp and flap her wings. So I, the king of Assyria, gathered all the countries. Not one flapped a wing or opened his mouth to chirp. Does the axe raise itself above him who swings it, or the saw against him who uses it? This is not Assyria talking now. This is not the king of Assyria talking, it's God's talking. He says this, does the axe raise itself above him who swings it? The axe, of course, is Assyria. The one who swings the axe is God. God is using Assyria to chop Jerusalem. And of course, no, the axe does not lord it over the person who's swinging the axe. Or the saw boast against him who uses it, as if a rod were to wield him who lifts it up, or a club brandish him who is not wood. He repeats the imagery four times with four different instruments, axe, saw, rod, club. It's the person who wields those instruments that's in charge, and God is in charge. Assyria is just an instrument. Verse 16, therefore the Lord Almighty, will send a wasting disease upon his sturdy warriors. Under his pomp a fire will be kindled like a blazing flame. Now this wasting disease occurred all in one night by an angel, 2 Kings 19:35. Which is labeled in the Holman Christian Study Bible, the defeat and death of Sennacherib. This is when Sennacherib's army was surrounding Jerusalem. 2 Kings 19:35. That night the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. When the people got up the next morning, there were all the dead bodies. Isaiah also mentions this event 27 chapters later in Isaiah 37, verse 36. Then the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. When the people got up the next morning, there were all the dead bodies. So those are historical accounts. This is a prophetic account of what's going to happen to the king of Assyria. In verse 16, Isaiah 10, the Lord will send a wasting disease upon his sturdy warriors. Under his pomp, a fire will be kindled like a blazing flame. Verse 17, the light of Israel will become a fire. Fire of judgment, of course. Light and fire are actually physically sort of related. The light of Israel, of course, is God. God will be a fire. Fire purifies, fire judges. Their Holy One, that's God, will become a flame. In a single day will burn and consume his thorns and briars. That happened when the armies surrounding Jerusalem were wiped out by that angel, by that plague. It happened in one day. Isaiah 37:36 says, when the people got up the next morning, there were all the dead bodies. The next morning, one day. Isaiah prophesies about that in Isaiah 10:17. In a single day, the fire of the Lord will burn and consume Assyria's thorns and briars. Verse 18, the splendors of his forest and fertile fields. Forest and fertile fields refers to the Assyrian army, which is going to get burnt down by the fire of God. It, the fire of God, will completely destroy the forest and fertile fields, the army, as when a sick man wastes away. And the remaining trees of his forest will be so few that a child could write them down, write their names down. Those of the Assyrian army that fled with Sennacherib the king from this place of plague around Jerusalem were not very many. They will be few, Isaiah prophesies in verse 19. We go now to Isaiah 10, verses 20 through 23. In that day, the remnant of Israel, in the day that the armies of Sennacherib are destroyed, in that day, the remnant of Israel, the survivors of the house of Jacob, will no longer rely on him who struck them down, but will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. A remnant will return. A remnant of Jacob will return to the mighty God. Though your people, O Israel, be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant will return. Destruction has been decreed, overwhelming and righteous. The Lord Almighty, will carry out the destruction decreed upon the whole land. Now Isaiah has turned from pronouncing doom and gloom on the nation of Assyria, and now he's coming back to talk about Israel. He says, in that day, a remnant will return. Who is that remnant? Well, here are three options. Those left after the invasion of Sennacherib. Sennacherib, of course, took all the cities of Israel around Jerusalem and almost got Jerusalem. But there were a few people left in Jerusalem that managed to survive. And that's the remnant that Isaiah is talking about here, according to this option. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, Guzik, Barnes, and Benson all say that this is the remnant. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says this, the effect on the remnant, namely those who shall be left after the invasion of Sennacherib, will be a return from dependence on external idolatrous nations, as Assyria, for example, to the God of the theocracy. All right, so we see this remnant, most probably those who were left in Israel after Sennacherib left, but some say it's those who returned from the Babylonian captivity. John Gill says that, favoring him, I would say in verse 22, the remnant is said to return. Though your people, O Israel, be like the sand by the sea, only a remnant will return. That sounds like the return from Babylon. But I've come up with option number three, only a remnant will return. Maybe it means return in their hearts to God. Whatever it refers to, it illustrates a very interesting point that God usually just deals with remnants. I mean, the elect of God are a minority in the history of the human race, a remnant, if you will. It's a big remnant. I mean, there's lots of people in the elect, but there's a lot more people who died and gone to hell with their hands clenched and their fists raised up against God. That's just the way history is. That's the way human beings are. Now, this remnant, these survivors, will no longer rely on Assyria who struck them down. Well, when did Israel ever rely on Assyria? Well, remember, Ahaz sent a bunch of money up to Assyria to try to induce Tiglath-Pileser III to attack Rezin of Syria and Pekah of Ephraim, both of whose kingdoms had allied to attack Jerusalem, to attack Judah, whose king Ahaz was. So Ahaz was relying on Assyria. In fact, that's the whole purpose of chapter 7. Isaiah is trying to talk Ahaz out of that alliance. He failed to do so. Ahaz eventually went ahead with it, but after God smacks Assyria down, well, then Israel's not going to be tempted to ally themselves with Assyria anymore. That's going to be it. Now, I mentioned just a minute ago that a remnant will return. That's in verse 21. Also in verse 22, this could be a reference to Shear-Jashub. That was Isaiah's son. Isaiah took Shear-Jashub to see Ahaz. And Shear-Jashub means a remnant shall return. And he's trying to tell Ahaz, look, Judah is not going to be entirely wiped out. There will always be a remnant. And that's true. Even after the attacks of Sennacherib in 701, even after the attacks of the Babylonians in 586, even after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, there's a remnant. And that's people who believe in God. And of course, now the remnant is us, all Christians, Jews and Gentiles. God exercises incredible biblical judgments on the world. But in the midst of all the judgments, there's always a remnant. Think about Noah's flood. That was a whopping big judgment. And yet there was a remnant of humanity that survived. 8 folks floating in the boat. God always preserves a remnant. And of course, I guess we should pray that we're in that remnant. Because judgment will come. God's not going to let evil people destroy his world. And so Ahaz, as evil as he was given some assurance through Isaiah that Pekah and Rezin would not destroy Ahaz's kingdom. In verse 22, Isaiah says, though your people, O Israel, be like the sand by the sea. And that Israel there, again, that could be northern Israel or southern Israel. I'm not going to get into that anymore, but there's an indication it could refer to northern Israel. Be like the sand by the sea. Now, Paul quoted that in Romans 9, 27 through 28, but Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, though the number of Israel's sons is like the sand of the sea, only the remnant will be saved. for the Lord will execute his sentence completely and decisively on the earth. Paul is trying to show that God is a God of judgment. Don't you complain, because there's only the elect, and who then can resist his will, and all the typical arguments that Arminians, unbelievers would throw at Paul. He says, no, God's going to execute his judgment. There's only going to be a remnant saved. He wasn't embarrassed about the fact that the elect were a remnant. This is a pleasant verse for universalists, by the way, who think that everybody's going to be saved. No, Paul says only the remnant will be saved. The remnant will return to the mighty God at the end of verse 21. This is a reference to Emmanuel, the Messiah, the mighty God. Isaiah 9, verse 6. For a child will be born for us, a son will be given to us, and the government will be on his shoulders. He will be named a Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God. So Jesus is called God because he is divine, just like God the Father is divine. Now at the end of verse 22, Isaiah says destruction has been decreed. And in verse 23, he says God will carry out the destruction decreed upon the whole land. Now when is this destruction again? We're going through this issue of which Assyrian invasion it was, or which invasion it was. Guzik says it's the Assyrians, but we have a problem, is Assyria didn't destroy all of Jerusalem. Well, if you still want to say it's the Assyrians that are being talked about here, which I tend to want to do, you could assume that this prophecy was given before 722, one of the options I talked about earlier. Well, then northern Israel was completely destroyed by the Assyrians in 722, wiped out. Or if you want to say it's the invasion of Sennacherib on Jerusalem in 701, Sennacherib didn't get Jerusalem, but the Assyrians did take all the land of Judah around Jerusalem. And notice that this destruction that Isaiah mentions in chapter 10, verse 23, is decreed upon the whole land, not just upon Jerusalem, but upon the whole land. And so that was destruction. Destruction has been decreed upon the whole land. Well, that's what happened to Israel. It got wiped out, except for the capital city. Well, if you don't like that interpretation, destruction decreed upon the whole land could refer to what the Babylonians did to Judah in 586 B.C. I'm still sticking with Assyria here in 701 B.C. We go down to Isaiah 10, verses 24 through 27. Therefore, this is what the Lord Almighty says. O my people who live in Zion, do not be afraid of the Assyrians, who beat you with a rod and lift up a club against you, as Egypt did. Very soon my anger against you will end, and my wrath will be directed to their destruction. That sounds like 701 B.C., does it not? The Lord Almighty will lash them with a whip, as when he struck down Midian at the rock of Oreb, and he will raise his staff over the waters, as he did in Egypt. In that day their burden will be lifted from your shoulders, their yoke from your neck. The yoke will be broken because you have grown so fat. So God tells the people of the Lord, don't be afraid of the Assyrians anymore. In verse 24 and verse 25, he says, very soon my anger against you will end. Well, that was in a very short time after Sennacherib had come up against Jerusalem. Very soon, very quickly. No more anger against Jerusalem, no more judgment on Jerusalem. Instead, judgment on the armies of Assyria, because his army was destroyed by an angel, Sennacherib's was, in 701 B.C. Verse 26, the Lord Almighty will lash them, the army of Sennacherib, with a whip, as when he struck down Midian at the rock of Oreb. This is referring to the destruction of the Midianites in the time of Gideon. After the initial battle there, Gideon chased down some bad guys. So this rock of Oreb took the name from the fleeing king, pagan king, two Midianite kings, Oreb and Zeb. And so some Ephraimites allied themselves with Gideon a little bit belatedly. They captured Oreb and Zeb, the two princes of Midian. This is in Judges 7:25. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb and Zeb at the winepress of Zeb while they were pursuing the Midianites. They brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon across the Jordan. Now, what's the comparison? This pagan king Oreb was killed, just like the Assyrian army is going to be killed. How were the destructions similar? They both were done in the night. They were both done immediately from the hand of the Lord. The destruction of the army of Assyria and the king of Oreb both were unthought of and unexpected. The troops of Oreb and the leaders of those troops, the princes of Oreb, fled and were taken and slain, just like the princes of Assyria were slain. Or it could just be that Oreb got whacked and Assyria got whacked. We don't have to be too particular about it. In verse 26, Isaiah says that God will raise his staff over the waters as he did in Egypt. And remember, Moses is always raising his staff, raising, all right, Pharaoh, here it comes. Another plague, another plague. So two destructions here are spoken of to compare with the destruction of Sennacherib's army. One is the Midianite army at the Rock of Oreb, and the other is the Egyptian army at the Red Sea. Verse 27, Isaiah says, in that day, the day that the Assyrians get whacked, in that day their burden will be lifted from your shoulders. Now, the Israelites were under the burden of the Assyrians. Their yoke will be lifted from your neck. The Israelites did have a yoke upon their neck from the Assyrians. We read in 2 Kings 18:14, so Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent word to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong, withdraw from me. Lachish is to the southwest of Jerusalem. Whatever you demand from me, Hezekiah says, I will pay the king of Assyria. The king of Assyria demanded 11 tons of silver and 1 ton of gold from King Hezekiah of Judah. That's a heap of money. A ton of gold? Oh my gosh. So yeah, they were under the burden of Assyria, but that was stopped after Assyria got decimated. Assyria's yoke will be broken because you have grown so fat, says Isaiah in verse 27. Fat means prosperous. So they go from almost being destroyed to very prosperous. That's good news. And again, that illustrates these prophecies. God judges his people. Then the next thing he knows, he saves. And now he's even making them prosperous. That's kind of the way it is, how he deals with his people, individually as well as churches today. We go now to Isaiah 10, verses 28 through 29. They, that's Sennacherib's army, enter Aath. They pass through Migron. They store supplies at Michmash. They go over the pass and say, we will camp overnight at Geba. Ramah trembles. Gibeah of Saul flees. Now, these place names describe the journey of Sennacherib on his way to Jerusalem, either directly from Assyria or on his return from Egypt. I looked at some maps. I'm not really sure that people know exactly when Sennacherib did that. But at any rate, he's coming to get Jerusalem, and this prophecy is so precise it mentions a bunch of place names. Benson says, though the description is a prophecy, he seems rather to speak like an historian who is relating facts already passed. Oh, I can hear the liberals now. Oh, that couldn't be done. There's no such thing as prophecy. We know because our naturalistic worldviews are always right and are never wrong. Well, I found a map on BibleAtlas.org that has all of these names, I think every one of them, on the map, with Jerusalem at the lower left-hand corner. As you go northeast, about maybe 10 miles, or due north, maybe 12 miles or so in that general area, you'll see these cities, starting at Aath, which is probably Ai. Gill says that Aath is thought to be the same with Ai. And then you come down a couple miles to the southeast to Migron, and then you go right next to Migron, across a path there is Michmash. That's where Jonathan got a great victory over the Philistines. And then if you go a couple miles to the southwest, you hit Geba, and then another 5 miles or so due west is Ramah, and then south about 5 miles, Gibeah, and then southeast about 2 or 3 miles is Galim, and then south about 3 or 4 miles, Nob, which is right behind the Mount of Olives, and then you go southeast about 3 or 4 miles, and you hit Jerusalem, southwest, I should say, you hit Jerusalem. I'll just mention some interesting facts about these cities. They're not that important for right now, but Michmash, as I mentioned, is where Jonathan got a great victory over the Philistines, 1 Samuel 13:23, and Ramah is where Rachel was buried, the mother of Benjamin, the wife of Jacob. And Gibeah is the city where the famous rape of the Levite's concubine occurred. And there was a civil war in Israel, so it's a pretty famous place. But at any rate, Sennacherib is coming on down to Jerusalem. These cities, by the way, in verses 28, 29, and as we go to 30, they're given in geographical order from north to south to show the march. We go down to verses 30 through 34, we will be finished with Isaiah 10. Cry out, O daughter of Galim, O Laisha, poor Anathoth, Madmena is in flight, the people of Geban take cover. All right, now here's some more cities. Galim is on my map, Anathoth is on my map, as you're going east from Gibeah, and end up right north of Nob, which of course is also on my map. Nob is the famous city of the priest. The ark was kept there for a while. I don't have Madmena and Geban on my map, but they're somewhere around there somewhere, the scholars say. Verse 32, this day they will halt at Nob. They will shake their fist at the mount of the daughter of Zion. Mount Zion, the daughter of Zion is the population of Zion. Of course, Mount Zion is the city of David, maybe the city of David plus Mount Moriah, right there in Jerusalem. The hill of Jerusalem is called in verse 32. Now, you can see Jerusalem from Nob. And so the Assyrians are shaking their fist at the Jerusalemites. Bad business. And then in verse 33, Isaiah says this, "The Lord," that's Yahweh, the Lord Almighty, "will lop off the boughs with great power." That's the leaders of the Assyrians. The lofty trees will be felled. The tall ones will be brought low. Those, again, are the leaders, the commanders of the Assyrian army. Yahweh will cut down the forest thickets. That's the common soldiers with an axe. Lebanon will fall before the mighty one. Now here, of course, this is not the town of Lebanon. It's referring to the Assyrian army, which is compared to the tall and stately forest of oak and cedar that one finds in Lebanon. And on that triumphant note, we are now finished with Isaiah chapter 10. We're ready to go now to chapter 11 of Isaiah in our next audio, which I will entitle "The Righteous Reign of the Branch." I hope you stay tuned for this next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.